Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau here on Monday, the 9th of January, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk to Amanda Compton and Brad Robbins about Wednesday's Mudrooms event. Bernie Muller will be here to talk about Red Cross disaster training opportunities. And we'll find out about the TV program Unraveling the Wind with guest Bea Adler. Mad Writers Almanac, Bird Don't Music, and more today on a Juneau afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight looks like mostly cloudy skies with scattered snow showers predicted. Low temperatures around 22 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, cloudy skies with a chance of snow in the afternoon with high temperatures around 34 degrees. Snow predicted for Tuesday night with high temperatures, low temperatures around 27 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, more snow with high temperatures around 34 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals will hear arguments today over whether a ski resort can use treated wastewater on an Arizona mountain sacred to tribes. Christina Onnested has more from San Francisco, California.
The Arizona Snowbowl Ski Resort wants to use up to 180 million gallons of treated sewage water each season to make snow on the San Francisco peaks in Arizona, an area sacred to more than 13 Native American tribes. Janita Benali is with the Save the Peaks Coalition, a plaintiff in the suit, alleging the government hasn't adequately evaluated the impacts snow made from wastewater could have on human health.
As a mother of two, I don't want my children, I don't want my community's children to be the test subject for, because the Forest Service failed to properly analyze reclaimed sewage effluent.
The Snow Bowl and the U.S. Forest Service has agreed to display signs warning the public to not eat the snow. But for activists like Benali, it's not enough. According to Benali, Arizona Snow Bowl would be the first ski resort in the world to use treated sewage water to make snow. Treated wastewater is currently used to irrigate farmland and parks. Native activists and tribes lost an earlier suit alleging the snowmaking violated Native American religious freedoms. Christina Onnested, San Francisco, California, National Native News.
An Oklahoma congressman has been successful in reconnecting a Choctaw Nation school to the Bureau of Indian Education. As KGOU's Kurt Gortney reports, the tribe is pleased with the move.
U.S. Representative Dan Boren added language to an omnibus federal appropriations bill recently approved by the House that allows the Jones Academy in Southeast Oklahoma to be eligible for federal funding. The language also means the school can become part of the Bureau of Indian Education system. Boren says the school's removal from the system dates back to a federal government program in the 1950s. It was repealed in 1970, but the removal remained intact. The 2nd District Democrat from Muskogee, Oklahoma, says schools like Jones Academy teach tribal languages and craftsmanship and are working to keep Native American culture from disappearing. Choctaw Nation Chief Gregory Pyle says the change will ensure that all students receive a complete academic education in a culturally rich setting. The school was first established in 1891 and has enrolled students from 29 tribes in at least 7 states. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
A Russian tanker is on its way to Nome, Alaska for a historic fuel delivery. A United States Coast Guard icebreaking cutter is escorting the tanker on the mission to deliver much-needed fuel to Nome. The delivery was expected to reach the community today, but the Coast Guard says it's taking longer than expected. According to the Associated Press, the ships were about 165 miles from Nome, averaging about 2 miles per hour, going through ice up to 2.5 feet thick. The unique voyage was initiated by the Sitnisok Native Corporation. The corporation contracted with Vitus Marine to deliver the fuel after the scheduled fall fuel barge did not arrive. The agreement is for delivery of more than 1 million gallons of petroleum products. According to the Native Corporation, this is the first time petroleum products will be delivered by sea to a Western Alaskan community in winter. In Minnesota, the State Education Department is holding a first-ever American Indian Education Summit. According to the Associated Press, the summit is aimed at reducing barriers facing the state's Native students. The keynote address is Denise Juneau. She's the superintendent of public instruction in Montana. Juneau is a member of the Mandan and Hidatsa tribes and is the first American Indian woman elected to a statewide position. Tribal and state education officials are expected to attend today's event in St. Paul. It comes after a listening session last fall on the state of Indian education in Minnesota. During this month in 1969, Navajo Community College opened its doors as the first tribally established and operated institution in the United States. Known today as Diné College, the school has several campuses throughout the Navajo Nation. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And the time is 3:06, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest here to talk about mudrooms, Amanda Compton, and also Brad Robbins. Thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Steph.
So first of all, what is a mudroom, Amanda?
I've answered that question probably a few times. Why don't I pun that off on Brad?
I think a mudroom is something similar to what we might know as an Arctic entry here in Alaska, where you sort of walk into the house, and it's separate from the house, and it's a place where you take off sort of your outer layers, your mud boots and maybe your raincoat, and set them there and then go into the house and outside your shell, I suppose.
And how does it relate to what's happening on Wednesday in the Peters Hall?
How does that relate? It relates because I took the idea from a event that occurs in Anchorage called Arctic Entries, and though the only connection we have is that I decided to use their format because it works, I wanted to show that we have some allegiance since we're in the same state, and so I used a synonym, and the catchphrase being that Anchorage is not any more sophisticated than we are, we're just a little bit muddier than they are, and put a metaphor on it, like a mudroom, you get a chance to see just a little bit into someone's lives, but you don't get to see the whole picture. And that's the platform for our event, Mudrooms, which is a live storytelling event. The second Wednesday of each month, so that would be this coming Wednesday, the 11th, we are having our second event. Our premiere was at the Rookery in November, and it was a hit. Jeff was gracious to host us before that on the show, and we had almost 100 people show up. It was wonderful. We had 7 people, including Brad, who's in the studio today, and we had a theme. The theme was, what was the theme, Brad?
I think it was preparation.
Preparation. Wednesdays will be outdated, and each of the 7 storytellers that we have will speak a personal story on that theme for 7 minutes. And so that'll be happening at McPheeters Hall this coming Wednesday.
What do you think accounts for its success?
What accounts for its success? I think that Juneau was really ripe for an event like this. It seems to me that there's a lot of interest and support for the arts and culture, and this was a kind of new event. I'm not knocking another musical event. It was just something different in that vein, and the community was really receptive to it. I would also say part of the success was the Rookery itself. They were open to providing us an environment that was pretty easy to perform in and recruit people like the audience members to come. It was right downtown. And also the storytellers. Once we had 7 people committed, they each kind of represented different social spheres. And so just them bringing in, say, 2, 3, 4 people really made it a hit. And I think that the personalized part of it, someone is telling a story from their heart that isn't rehearsed. They're not going to a play. They're not going to a theater. It's like sitting down and getting to hear parts of people's lives that's intimate that you wouldn't otherwise find yourself in a position to be listening to.
Brad, why did you participate last year, and what did you participate as?
I participated as a speaker, and I was pretty excited to do a storytelling event. That's something that I grew up around, going to storytelling festivals and listening to people tell stories, and I really enjoy it. And I've found here in Alaska, everybody has a story of some sort. And so it was nice to be able to get in there with folks that you may not necessarily sit down with on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis. but you'd seen everyone around, and dude, you wouldn't necessarily be able to hear their stories, and this was a good venue for to be able to sit and listen to stories that you may not hear, just like Amanda was speaking about.
What kind of story did you tell?
I told a story of being a very, very young child and getting into my father's chewing tobacco and chewing it and thinking that I was going to die. And so my story was about the preparations that I made to leave this earthly world as a four-year-old boy.
Including, I think he had a quote that said, "It's been a good life." It was fabulous.
Yeah, it was a fun story to tell. I've told it a million times in my life, and it was one of my earliest memories of childhood. And thank God I made it through it.
It's amazing when your first memories would be a near-death experience as a four-year-old.
I was ready.
And one thing I would like to point out that Brad said was that he got a chance to see or listen to people he wouldn't normally say sit down and have a cup of coffee with. And that's part of the vision that I'd like to see continued, is that we do get to hear from, we get comfortable in our same circle of friends, or we call the same certain people, but yet there's all these different people out there that we can connect to in different ways. And this is a way to see and hear people that you don't always, you wouldn't always approach, and you wouldn't always get to know. That's kind of the point.
Plus, this personal experience is not like listening to a story on the radio. It's like, you know, you're one-on-one with a person, or one-on-100 in this case.
Yeah.
That sort of alludes to something that I wanted to mention. When I'm going to have to admit, I was a little bit nervous before I got up there because I hadn't rehearsed it. And I got up there and I faced the audience, and it was a packed house. It really was, in the Rookery. It's not the largest venue, but anyway, when I turned around, I looked and I saw that I knew most of the folks, and their faces were warm and eager to hear what I had to say. And so I began my story, and then as I continued on in my story, as I scanned the audience, I realized that most of the people in the audience I had told a story to before. So it's just like you said, Jeff, it's one-on-one or 1 on 100. And so I guess my anxiety was quelled pretty quickly once I recognized that I knew everyone there for the most part. And so I was comfortable.
What kind of story are you going to tell on Wednesday at the McCedersall event?
I'm going to be on the other side of the microphone on Wednesday, I think. I'll be in the audience.
We have 7 entirely different speakers lined up for Wednesday. We've got Jeff Kirsch, who is a well-known funny man in town, among other things. He's a dad. And also we have Jesse Keel, who will be speaking. We have 2 Lindas. We have a Linda Mancuso, and we have a Linda Buxley. And we have Rachel Brown will be speaking. How many is that? Tom Cosgrove. I think that's 7.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do you recruit your storytellers? Is there a filtering process? Screening?
I use a combination of nagging and tactful persistence has been what I've done. But we do have people sometimes volunteer. We get referenced by other people. Oh, this person's really funny. You should email that person. And that has led to people coming up. We're hoping as more of these take place, people will realize this is a really comfortable environment. I'd love to try this. You know, I have this funny story, and I've just either, or I could come up with a funny story, and I've never done this sort of thing before, and it doesn't require experience, and this could be something really fun. And we're hoping as more people attend it, as word gets out, that the recruiting process won't be as take up as much time. We'll have more, and this is true in the case of this coming event. We'll have more people contacting us and saying, "I'd like to tell a story."
This is all happening Wednesday at 7 p.m. in McPeters Hall. How do people get tickets?
They just come. We don't have tickets. We charge $7 at the door, and all of our profits are going to the Glory Hall. We gave about $500 to them in November, and we have moved to McPeters Hall, which charges, so we do expect not only, we expect to have more people, so we should be able to donate a similar amount of money this time, too. We're going to stick with the Glory Hole and then rotate different charities like every 3 or 4 months.
If people need more information, I guess they should just come down to McPheeters Hall on Wednesday.
Come to McPheeters Hall. We have a website in the works. We're trying to collect photographs, which we'll do at the next event in order to have something to put on the website. We have posters around town with our email, with his, and pretty much people either know Alita Bus or me or someone who might know them, and then and Lauren Brooks, and you're absolutely able to email us if you'd like any information.
And how do they email you?
They email me at juno.mudrooms@gmail.com.
All right, I've been talking to Amanda Compton and Brad Robbins about Mudrooms. This is Wednesday at 7 p.m. at McPheeters Hall. $7 to get in, and it's a benefit for the Glory Hole. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
How fun was it, Brad?
A lot of fun.
Yeah. So come on by.
Tell me a story of days gone by. I want to leave this life of mine. Nothing, sorrow, and pain I find. Tell me a story of days. Tell me of princes, jesters, and kings, town fools, crown jewels, scepters, and rings, goodies and little girls lost in the woods. Tell me of axes, tell me of woes, tell me of stories.
Brand new from the brand new Barefoot CD. Time is 3:18, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Ernie Muller from the Red Cross here to talk about disaster training. Ernie, thank you very much for being on the station today.
Thank you.
So first of all, tell me about the Red Cross in Juneau, please, if you could, please.
Well, the Red Cross has been in Juneau since 1917. We got a picture of a bunch of nurses marching down Front Street in our office that was taken in 1917. And I think a lot of the Red Cross in Alaska was started about the time of the First World War to support the military effort. And then that's dwindled a bit after the war, but the Red Cross stayed in Juneau. And we've been responding to disasters and teaching first aid and supporting swimming instruction and stuff like that ever since.
What kind of notable emergencies have happened in Juneau's history that the Red Cross has responded to?
Well, we respond to, most of what we respond to are single-family fires and small house fires. But 2 years ago, we responded to a landslide above Gastineau Avenue, which caused an evacuation of about 75 people. And we put up a shelter and supported about 35 people during the shelter overnight, fed them, set up a shelter in Centennial Hall, which is a pre-designated city shelter, or one of the pre-designated city shelters. We haven't done that since then. We've been doing some work around town, looking at different places that are going to be set up to be shelters in the event of an emergency. We've set up a couple of shelters for cruise ship evacuations as a result of cruise ship fires or groundings, that sort of thing. We had an interesting one a number of years ago when a volcano erupted up in Cook Inlet and caused their airplanes to be diverted, and we ended up having to set up a shelter out at the airport for about 30 people who were stuck here overnight, couldn't find a hotel to stay in. So those sorts of things are the sort of shelters that we set up, as well as responding directly to single-family fires and other individual disasters, which is the largest number of disasters that we respond to involve single families.
And the Red Cross is not a government-funded agency, is it?
No, it isn't. We are chartered by Congress. We've been chartered by Congress several times over the years. A lot of organizations are, and we receive no funding from the federal government. All of our funding comes from donations.
What happens when a disaster is looming or is happening at the present time?
Well, what happens here is that we will probably get a call from the city, which would be the city's emergency manager, or from the fire department or the police department or the dispatcher. And they will call one of our volunteer disaster action team captains, who will then call upon the volunteers to respond to the disaster. And as it gets bigger, then they'll call me, they'll call Anchorage, they'll call the state headquarters, whatever needs to be done.
How many staff people do you have and how many volunteers?
We have two part-time staff people in Juneau, myself and the health and safety services specialist, and we have a Matura, Alaska seeking skills training volunteer that works in the office, and she does a lot of our office work. And then we have probably in town somewhere around 30 volunteers.
What role do volunteers play?
Volunteers do a lot of things. We have volunteer instructors whose only volunteer job is to teach health and safety services classes. These are primarily first aid and CPR AED classes. Sometimes it's wilderness first aid classes. We have a volunteer instructor who's done it for over 40 years. We have disaster volunteers serve a number of roles, but their primary roles is as first responders to single-family fires, avalanches, houses knocked down, the sort of things that natural emergencies that might occur in any town like this. And they also can be deployed to state and national disaster response, and they may have specialties in that area, whether it's going to be health services, it could be nursing, could be working in a shelter, could be assessing disaster-related damage, logistics, all kinds of functions that need to be in a big disaster like we had with Hurricane Irene last fall.
And you have some disaster classes coming up?
We do. Every fall and every spring, we look for new disaster volunteers and refresh the training of our volunteers that have been around for a while, and starting next week, we'll be doing disaster training. We're looking for volunteers, but if people just want to find out what the Red Cross's disaster response is, we'd love to have you come in and sit in our class and learn about it, even if you never spend another day with us.
What kind of things go on during a class?
We'll have first class is called Disaster Services Overview, and it's a course that just talks about the Red Cross and the history of the Red Cross, the history of the Red Cross's responses, and how an individual can be a volunteer and what kind of volunteer jobs that they can get. That class starts a week from tomorrow, on Tuesday the 17th. And then after that, we require all of our disaster volunteers to take sheltering classes, and that's an all-day Saturday class. And we also have a client casework course that lasts all day. And that class is intended to teach people – no, it's actually a half a day now. I keep thinking that these things are longer than they are. But like everybody else, we found out that people that volunteer only have so many hours, and their hours are real valuable, so we've been shortening up our courses. So the client casework course is only 4 hours now, and it teaches people how to go out and help people who have suffered from disasters like single-family fires. And the volunteers in the Red Cross actually provide the financial assistance to people. And we trust them, and they decide this is what our clients get. And that happens. That's worked out really well for us over the years.
Where are the classes held?
They're held either in our office, and people can call me at 463-5713, and we have a small conference room there. And for the longer classes, we're holding them at the Bartlett Hospital Conference Center on Saturdays.
Is there a fee?
No, it's free. All of our disaster assistance is free, and all of our classes are free. We need disaster volunteers, and they can get the training for nothing.
You mentioned earlier people who are just interested in Red Cross response can attend, but also do you look for a time commitment for a standard volunteer?
We do. We like people to sign up about once a month or twice a quarter as a on-call person for a week. And we have a disaster action captain, and then they'll have an assistant, and they'll both pick a week and stick up with that week for a month and then see how it goes.
You mentioned sheltering class. What happens in a sheltering class?
Well, a sheltering class is mostly theory, and we just talk about and work on how a shelter operates. We give a lot of information about the functions of a shelter, how you set it up, how you take it down, how you operate it. And then the other half of the class is what we call a simulation class. Well, we break the class up into a sheltering team, and we just give them a problem to solve. And they sit down amongst themselves. They decide who's going to be the shelter manager, and they decide how to solve these problems. And then we have what we call in the disaster exercise business an inject, which is a problem to solve. So partway through, they're working on how to set up a shelter, for example, and how to make a schedule or whatever it is. And we'll throw something in there. Like somebody brings a mean, ugly dog into the shelter and wants to keep it there. What are you going to do? Or somebody shows up intoxicated, or two people get into a fight. How do you respond to that as a shelter management team?
So once again, those classes, date and times, and now people get older.
Okay, well, they can call me. The first class is on the 17th at our office, Tuesday the 17th, from 6 to 9, I think it is. And following that, on the following Saturday, all day long, it's a class up at the airport. How about the Bartlett Hospital training rooms for shelter operations? And we'll go from there and see how we do.
And Ernie Miller talking Red Cross disaster training. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Well, not that I know of, but I can give you my email address as if anybody. Well, do better than that. I'll give you our website, which is www.alaska.redcross.org. And on that, you can search around and find how to get a hold of us. Otherwise, you can call us at 463-5713.
Ernie Miller, thank you very much for coming down to the station today and talking about the Red Cross.
Thank you, Jeff.
Unselfishly giving, courageous and bold. Modest and painfully shy, an angel determined to fly, giving hope and strength to the needy. Angel, miracle woman, lady in red. Could have remained with your teaching instead. You did all you could do and more, nursing the soldiers wounded in war. Wherever you went, they knew you were heaven sent. Angel of mercy. It was your calling to serve. It was your calling to lead. So you overcame your shyness. There were people in need. As a result of your compassion and your self-control, the American Red Cross. unselfishly giving, courageous and bold. You were true to your call as you gave your all. Inspiration, heart of a nation, angel of mercy.
Jonathan Sprout, the time is 3:32, and you are tuned to KTWO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Bea Adler. She's a filmmaker involved with the film group Story Knife Films. They put together a film called Unraveling the Wind. It's about bush pilots in the south central, southwest corner of Alaska. And it's a great film. I saw it the other day, and it's going to be on 360 North Wednesday at 8 p.m. and also Sunday at 7 o'clock in the evening, and also other times. You should check your 360north.com for other airings. Bea Adler, thank you very much for being on the station with me today.
I'm delighted to be here.
So tell me a little bit about the Story Knife Films organization, please.
Well, we started out calling ourselves Four Valley Chicks, Matsu Valley, all of us with teaching and storytelling backgrounds. And we came together because one of the group, Ori Rich, who was teaching at Wasilla High School at the time, wanted to tell a story that she knew was rapidly disappearing. The first generation of Alaska Native pilots was coming towards the end of some of their lives. One of our group, Alice Alstrom Henderson, was the great niece of the two twin brothers, Fred and Frank Alstrom, who were the first Native Alaskans to get their pilot's license in the state. So we wanted to tell their story. We came together and thought, well, what else do we need? We're storytellers, we're teachers. I was invited into the group as a writer and as a person who knew how to get grants. I teach grant writing at the local college, and I've done a lot of work with nonprofits over the years. And I invited a friend of mine to come into the group, Deborah Schild, who is a real filmmaker. She joined us, and so the four of us formed Story Knife.
How do you decide what things to tell stories about?
It's not very hard to find good stories to tell. We're so interested in so many different things. The thing that we shared in our fascination with the subject we chose for our first film, which is what Unraveling the Wind is, was how Native traditions are still so valuable in contemporary technology, that the past informs the present and the future.
I know you say this very eloquently in your film, but why are bush pilots important, especially in that region, and why is it important for Native bush pilots to get training?
As Oscar Quagley, who was a wonderful man who is in our film, said to us many times, it's important to know how to make a living and make a life at the same time. For people who are raised in the villages throughout Alaska, that way of life is a very unique thing. People have one foot in the modern world, one foot in the past, and cherish the benefits of both. How can you support someone who wants to live a subsistence lifestyle and carry on traditions that are important to them and their family while enabling them to make a living in a cash-dependent society? Aviation is one field that's so vital to anyone in the rural parts of our state. You can't get there from here without a plane. And so learning how to fly them, maintain them, support the entire industry is something that is increasingly becoming part of the native population's lives there. They're not dependent on people, oh, as we've been told by people who run flight services, that people would come up from California, put in their hours, and have accidents because the terrain is harsh. The language is sometimes difficult. By training people from the region, people who've grown up in the villages, by having a school in the region that they can go to without their having to go to Fairbanks or Anchorage for training, keeps it working for them, enables them to stay in touch with their families, continue their traditional lifestyles, learn modern skills that enable them to support families without having to leave the village, which is so important to so many of them.
You want to talk about the turnover rate of many Alaskan bush pilots?
Oh, yes. Accidents, terrible experiences that people who come to the bush from other states, even from other parts of Alaska who have no experience there, it's a hard environment. It's not for everyone. And so people who are from those areas are comfortable there. They know the terrain. They know what to expect. And as Ori Rich, who's part of Story Knife, is now working for an organization based out of Bethel. She's moved back up to the Bethel area. And she tells me that so many of the graduate pilots from the school in Bethel are the ones that she's flying with now as she travels around the villages doing the educational programs that she's working on now.
Tell me more about the flight school, if you could, please.
Certainly. It started as a part of the tribal college, and they wanted to have a school that would enable young Native students to get their pilot's training without having to go to Anchorage or Fairbanks. They were very innovative in that they could speak Yupik in the classroom if it was necessary to have the lessons fully understood. There's a lot of math involved. There's a lot of science involved. It's very technical. And so we were privileged to be there the day the first graduate came back in from Anchorage with his full commercial license. And I think that was maybe in 2001. I'm not sure right now. But the school is thriving now. It has become its own nonprofit organization and is not part of the tribal college any longer. And they are continuing to train and graduate well-qualified pilots, and has stimulated additional courses for A&P mechanics, for ground service, so that the aviation industry in Bush, Alaska can be Native-managed, Native-staffed.
I'm talking to Bea Adler, a filmmaker involved with the group Story Knife Films. She's produced a film with her of her compatriots called Unraveling the Wind. It's going to be shown on 360 North Television this Wednesday at 8 p.m., also Sunday at 7 p.m., and if you need more air times, you can check our website, 360north.com, for other airings. The title of the film, Unraveling the Wind, where did that come from?
It came from Oscar Quagley. We were talking about where that nexus was between traditional skills and technical capabilities. And he said, well, the old people used to talk about people who knew how to read the weather. They could smell the wind. They knew when the weather would change long before anyone else would. And he used a Yupik word, which I'm not going to mangle in pronunciation. But you can hear him say it in the film. And he told us that its literal English translation was those who unravel. Well, we adopted that then and considered that we're talking about how you unravel the wind in order to understand what it's telling you about how the weather will change. And, of course, weather for pilots is paramount.
What other films are you working on in present time?
Right now we're continuing our theme of education. We're all teachers of one sort or another. We don't have an actual topic nailed down just yet. It'll probably be a few more months before we pick among the choices that we're looking at right now. I hope it doesn't take us 7 years to produce the next film. This one did take that long. I think now that we know the ropes a bit more, we'll be able to take a lot less time. But, you know, we all work. And so we have to balance our family lives, our work lives, and our passion for telling stories with film.
What do you think of the future of the pilots in the school is?
Oh, I think it's fantastic. I think their 100% safety record, I think the fact that they can outperform previous year's records when pilots with more experience had more accidents. I think the economic development and the positive role models that it brings to the villages who send students to the school is priceless. As we go forward, especially in uncertain economic times, the ability to have a local job to service your friends, relatives, neighbors who need to fly to get from place to place, that's always going to be there. I think that, you know, just as we need to have cars to get around where we live, they need to have planes. They need pilots who can fly them safely. I think it's an industry that's going to continue to need well-trained pilots, and the school is doing a wonderful, wonderful job. We've been selling copies of the video, and the profits do go to support the school because it's such a worthwhile endeavor.
How do people get copies?
We have been using the Anchorage Museum of History and Art as our primary resource right now. It seems the simplest. We are not set up to sell them directly. And so if anyone wants to send an email to the Anchorage Museum of History and Art, I'm looking for the actual email address and I'm not spotting it quickly, they would be able to inquire about that. It's the museum store at the Anchorage Museum of History and Art.
Unraveling the Wind, a film about Native bush pilots in the southwest area of Alaska. It will be on 360 North on this Wednesday at 8 p.m. at Sunday at 7 o'clock and other times throughout the week. Check 360north.com for other airings. Also, 360 North is going to be offering some films from the Museum of the North Collection in the beginning of next week. Adler, thank you very much for being on the show with me today. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Well, I hope people will watch the film. If they have any additional questions, they could email me at badler@gci.net.
Randy, thank you very much for being on the air with me today.
My pleasure.
Stayed and I damn near didn't come back again. I didn't go very fast on a steam-powered aeroplane. Oh, the wheel went around and up and down and inside and then back again. Sitting in 747 just watching them clouds roll by. Can't tell if it's sunshine or if it's rain. Hey, hey. Rather be sitting in a deck chair high up over Kansas City on a genuine old-fashioned authentic steam-powered aeroplane. Thank you. again. And wear a blue hat, yeah, that says steam-powered aeroplane. Letters go round the rim and then back again. Sitting in a 747 just watching them clouds roll by. Can't tell if the sunshine or if it's rain, hey, hey. Rather be sitting in a deck chair high up over Kansas City on a genuine old-fashioned authentic steam-powered aeroplane.
From her album Moonlighter, and before that, the incomparable John Hartford.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 9th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of the New York Times critic Michiko Kakutani, born in New Haven, 1955, daughter of a Yale mathematician, herself a graduate of Yale. She worked as a reporter before becoming a book critic at the Times in 1983. Since then, she's made a reputation for herself as a fearsome reviewer, one who's unafraid to take on the famous and distinguished, as she did recently in a scathing review of an Anne Beattie novel, which Cacciatani described as pretentious, narcissistic, self-indulgent, hot air-filled, a tome that wastes the reader's time with silly creative writing class exercises. Many writers gotten upset by her, including Salman Rushdie, who called her weird, Susan Sontag, who used the words stupid and shallow, and Jonathan Franzen, who called Cacciatani the stupidest person in New York City. Fisk University first opened its doors on this day, 1866, Nashville, one of the first American colleges founded for black students, housed in the abandoned barracks of Union soldiers provided by General Clinton Fisk. The funds for the construction of a permanent building were raised by the school's famous Fisk Jubilee Singers, a touring choir composed primarily of former slaves who performed for President Grant in the White House and Queen Victoria in England. Mark Twain wrote about the Fisk Jubilee Singers, "I heard them sing once, and I would walk 7 miles to hear them sing again," which is strong language for me to use when you remember that I never was fond of pedestrianism. It was on this day, 1493, Christopher Columbus, navigating the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria near the coast of the Dominican Republic, on his way to what he believed was a route to Asia, wrote in his journal that he'd seen 3 mermaids. He said they came up very high out of the sea, but they are not as beautiful as they are painted. What he actually saw were probably manatees. It was 5 years ago today that Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone to an audience at Apple's annual Macworld Expo, the first smartphone to use touchscreen technology, the first to access the Internet with full web browsing capabilities. Apple's shares went up immediately from $7 to over $92. And it was on this day, 1956, Dear Abby first appeared in print, San Francisco Chronicle, by Abigail Van Buren, the pen name of Pauline Friedman, whose twin sister Esther, or Epi Friedman, had taken over the Ann Landers column in the Chicago Sun-Times. Sisters who grew up in Sioux City, Iowa, had a bitter rivalry at first and then publicly reconciled. Ann Landers died in 2002. The Dear Abby column is written by Pauline's daughter, Jean. Here's a poem for today by Mark Strand, entitled A Short Panegyric. Panegyric, a eulogy or oration. A short panegyric. Now that the vegetarian nightmare is over, and we're back to our diet of meat, and deep in the sway of our dark and beautiful habits, and able to speak with calm of having survived, let the breeze of the future touch and retouch our large and hungering bodies. Let us march to market to embrace the butcher and put the year of the carrot, the month of the onion behind us. Let us worship the roast or the stew that takes its place once again at the sacred center of the dining room table. A Short Panegyric by Mark Strand from Almost Invisible, published by Alfred A. Knopf and used by permission here in the Writer's Almanac, supported by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines. Produced by Kathy Roach and written by Heather McPherson. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Tonight on 360 North, at 7 p.m., get national and international news from the BBC. Then, current conditions and forecasts across the state on Alaska weather at 7:30. Surviving Sub-Zero, the Ingenuity of Lemmings and Voles, that's on Science for Alaska at 8, followed at 9 by Fortunate Wilderness, the Wolf and Moose Study of Ile Royale from PBS. Healthy Body, Healthy Mind is at 10, tonight on 360 North.
is Bird Note. Each season ushers in its own bounty of bird life. Winter is the best season to highlight North America's feathered thunderbolts, the falcons. Northern nesting species of falcons, like this peregrine we're hearing, move southward, closer to their many admiring observers. Hurtling through the air on blade-like wings, falcons rank among the fastest of all birds and the most adept at capturing prey in flight. One falcon much more prevalent across the U.S. in winter is the merlin. 10 inches tall with a 2-foot wingspan, the merlin chases down small birds from sparrows to sandpipers. Small but powerful, the fearless merlin will buzz even a huge eagle that enters its airspace. The majestic jeer falcon drifts south in winter to the northern tier of states. Larger than a red-tailed hawk, in a direct sprint, the jeer falcon can overtake even the fastest duck. The mid-sized peregrine falcon nests in some locales across the country, but its numbers are greatest in winter, especially near the coasts. During its dive on a hapless pigeon or dunlin, a peregrine may reach an airspeed approaching 200 miles an hour. If you'd like to share this show with a friend, begin at our website, birdnote.org.
Time is 3:58 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Behind us, the music of the Buena Vista Social Club album. KTOO broadcasts at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valianoc Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Huna at 91.9. An excursion inland and icy strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873. We're also online at www.ktoo.org. Coming up tomorrow on a June afternoon, a retrospective of the career of Paul Simon and his latest album. For the forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with scattered snow showers, low temperatures around 23 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow in the afternoon and high temperatures around 32 degrees. Tuesday night, snow mixing with rain with accumulation of 1 to 2 inches expected of snow. Low temperatures around 28 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday and Wednesday night looks like rain and snow with high temperatures around 34 degrees. Coming up next is All Things Considered. Thank you very much for tuning into a June afternoon today and have a great evening.
Para Marcané, llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarí.